Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On Monday, the man known as the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo, appeared in a California courtroom to plead guilty to 26 charges that stem from 13 murders and 13 rapes that he committed in the 1970s and 80s. He also admitted to 62 other crimes, but because of the statute of limitations, he can't be charged for them. DeAngelo's case went cold for decades, yet a group of true crime writers and citizen detectives worked tirelessly to track down leads. One of them was Michelle McNamara, a popular true crime blogger and writer. In fact, it was she who referred to him as the Golden State Killer in an LA magazine piece she wrote, and the name stuck. She was deeply entrenched and became obsessed, frankly, as she worked on a book about the GSK. That is, until she suddenly died at age 54 in April of 2016. Her death shocked many, and it made news. She was the wife of actor Patton Oswalt. Oswalt, Michelle's editor, and her true crime colleagues banded together to finish her book, which became a bestseller, and now a six-part docuseries called I'll Be Gone in the Dark, airing on HBO Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Joining me now is Liz Garbus, the series director. She's an Oscar-nominated and Emmy and Peabody Award-winning director and producer of films that include What Happened, Miss Simone, Bobby Fischer Against the World, and The Ghosts of Abu Ghraib. Liz, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So when you were thinking about approaching this series, given it is a really well-known subject matter, what did you want to add? What did you want to illuminate?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just wanted to say she passed away when she was 46, not 46. 54.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry about that.
Yeah, which is, you know, is equally, you know, 54 is too young anyway. You know, for me, the Golden State Killer wasn't a story I knew about, but at the end of the day, it wasn't so much who this man was or exactly what he did or his identity that was of interest in terms of the storytelling of the series. Of course, his identity is of interest in terms of justice, but what I thought we could do that really hadn't been explored before was kind of, you know, extend Michelle's approach and legacy in terms of talking to the survivors, foregrounding their stories, and also sort of illuminating this world of citizen sleuths who have come together and in actually working in partnership with law enforcement quite often to come together and try to solve these cases. In Michelle's case, what she did was she was able to cast a national spotlight on this case. It had previously been sort of somewhat under the radar outside of the areas where he was attacking. He had these terrible monikers like East Area Rapist, Original Night Stalker, Visalia Ransacker. Mm-hmm. None of them stuck. And she renamed him the Golden State Killer, which is now how he's known today. And which had a big part of people paying attention to this case again, which was so important.
The series really gets into the lives, how people's lives were forever changed by Golden State Killer, his survivors, the law enforcement and citizen detectives who tried to find him, and of course, Michelle McNamara. As someone who's been steeped in this, why do you think this case had such an impact on so many people? What was it about this case?
Well, I mean, his crime spree lasted over a decade. It crossed many jurisdictions. The jurisdiction, law enforcement in their particular jurisdictions were flummoxed and not able to connect one string of attacks to another string of attacks. That he was able to commit 50 rapes. You hear 12, now we know it's 13 murders, but then you think 50 rapes. Mm-hmm. As one of our survivors said, you know, a rape is a soul murder. It's never finished. And this crime spree was extensive. One has to wonder the way that rape was regarded in the 70s and 80s, not saying where we need to be today, but in many jurisdictions it was a misdemeanor. So what kind of attention was given to this string of rapes when it first started and enabled it to go on so long?
Yeah, you really get it. It's a very interesting part of the documentary. You get the sense of the cultural attitudes about rape at the time. And you show this archival footage of films that give women tips on how to avoid being attacked. Let's take a listen to one of them. We can talk about it on the other side.
Sex offender today has a greater number of available women to choose from. There are more working women, single women living alone, not with their families or with men.
Because of the mobility and the visibility of today's woman, she must learn to understand the rapist. For today's woman to understand the rapist, she's got to learn to understand the man.
The young girl made one bad move after another. Her attitude was much too inviting. She should never have stopped to window shop at night. She parked in a dark section of the parking lot and didn't have her keys ready in her hand.
So Liz, in terms of trying to solve this case, what was the effect of this cultural attitude that somehow women were partially responsible in some way for this violence?
Well, I think there are two answers. I mean, the first answer is, you know, answers your question, which how does it affect the investigation? You know, law enforcement at first wanted to keep it quiet, you know, didn't want everybody in the, you know, in the East area to feel afraid. Was that the best decision? I don't know. And, you know, what were, you know, we met a lot of the detectives who worked on this case. You have to think that the classification of rape as a misdemeanor puts it in a different bucket than it were if it was considered a felony, or, you know, it would have been more of a priority for law enforcement. The second answer is, what is the effect of that kind of discourse or that kind of understanding of rape on the survivors? And that's massive. Mm-hmm. You know, marriages broke up months after a husband had his wife raped next to him in bed. Those marriages could not withstand that, it seems. There was probably not the vocabulary for men to, I'm just, you know, guessing or I'm, you know, surmising based on my conversations with survivors, the vocabulary for them to get through that. A young girl who's 15 is raped. Is chastised for talking on the phone with a friend about it. So the kind of attitude towards rape, the shame involved, certainly made this a cancer that could grow and metastasize within the survivors in a way that you know, we hope is starting to change.
Yeah, there's this really sort of dramatic moment. It's subtly dramatic when one of the survivors is telling her story and the camera stays on the husband. And his face and his hands and his body language throughout her entire description is really telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it's interesting, and I feel like people read it different, you know, read that reaction differently. Mm-hmm. For me, it feels to me like a man grappling with what the ideas of masculinity were for him, that mm-hmm. he should have somehow been able to stop this attack and protect his wife, you know, even though he was bound and gagged. And I still feel him grappling under that sort of feeling of you know, if what society would have expected of him. But there he was kind of sticking by his wife's side and listening. And I find it very, very moving. But yeah, the East area, the Golden State Killer was really, there was a kind of psychological torture that went beyond the violent act itself.
My guest is Liz Garsbeth, series director for I'll Be Gone in the Dark. So the series is based on this book Michelle McNamara was working on. And even though she's no longer with us, she's very present in the film. The actress Amy Ryan reads from her emails, and there are blogs. Do you include texts and voicemails? Why did you go this route creatively?
Well, you know, once we started working on it and Patton Oswalt, her husband, shared with us her phones, her tape, her mini cassettes that she had, in which she had taped interviews with law enforcement and survivors, we just felt like there was a way to make our viewer feel like they were by Michelle's side as she was going on this journey. You got to hear her learn things for the first time, test out theories with fellow sleuths for the first time. And it felt like an exciting opportunity for storytelling to make you feel that you were there alongside her. And also it helps you get to know her. She's our protagonist, she's our heroine. That doesn't mean she was a perfect human being. None of us are. I think that it was also a way to get insight into this very special human being.
Well, we do get to see her in some videos, and I wanted to play a little clip. This is her in her own words explaining what drives her when she's writing about an unsolved case. This is from I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
What I love is this intersection of sort of technology and crime solving, in that people can get sort of wheeled out of their house for something they did in 1957 because of the internet, because of DNA. I really get off on that. That is so amazing to me. And I want to be a part of that. Nothing, it's, you know, everyone has their cause. And this just feels like what I was born to do. I love digging for clues. I love putting things together. I love the puzzling part of it. I love being wrong because sometimes it proves that you didn't know enough and you learn new techniques. I love every single aspect of it.
Liz, what was different or unique about Michelle McNamara's writing and the way she covered and wrote about true crime at that time?
Well, she started her blog, True Crime Diary, before I think the two words together, true crime, were, you know, on the tip of everyone's tongue. So she was sort of a pioneer in that space. She was really interested in unsolved cases. I mean, she wasn't interested in poring over the details of a Ted Bundy or something. She wanted to try to find the guy who did it. And then the other thing is just her voice as a writer. Her editor at HarperCollins said, you know, this was the most incredible piece of literary true crime I had ever read since In Cold Blood. I mean, and that's high praise. So I think that those who will read the book and also hear the excerpts read in our book, in our series, will get acquainted with an incredibly talented writer whose empathy is deep and whose precision and language is really able to bring you very close to something that's often very hard to look at.
I'm curious, I have not read the book, but, and I'll try not to do any spoilers because I watched the whole series. It's very scary at certain points. I was home alone and I checked the doors 3 times. I'm not kidding. It really got under my skin and watching it. How did you feel about it as you worked on the series? I mean, this is a sort of a silly way to put it, but did you get creeped out working on this?
Yeah, I did. I mean, but I think that for me, what I thought of in those moments was I have this whole team I'm working with. I have wonderful fellow directors and producers and associate producers and editors. And when we would be working through the photos or the descriptions of the crimes, we could talk to each other and sort of have community. And it made me think so much of Michelle, who, you know, writing is so solitary and doing that alone and the stresses and nightmares that she had. And I felt personally grateful for my community and also very sad that Michelle didn't have that. I mean, of course, she had fellow sleuths, she had a husband, but the work she was doing was alone in the middle of the night.
And that's
really hard. Yeah.
You get to that in the film that her devotion and her obsession wasn't necessarily healthy for her and her emotional state. What kind of toll did it take on her without giving too much away?
Well, she put an enormous amount of pressure on herself to not only write a book, which had been like a lifelong dream of hers, to be a published author. So that was huge for her. But also to solve the case. I mean, she just wanted to write this book and have found the guy in the end. And she had so much material. She was given boxes and boxes and boxes of police files that no one outside of the police force had ever seen. So it was this sense, well, if I just spend one more hour or I just do, read that thing again and look for something, then maybe I can crack this. And that pressure was huge. And, you know, as we know, Michelle did take prescription drugs to help her get through those tough moments. And that was a contributing factor to her death.
My guest is Liz Garbus. We're talking about the new series, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which airs Sundays on HBO at 10 p.m. We've been talking about these citizen detectives, and it's an online community she discovered, and a group of people who are equally as engaged and devoted to trying to solve some of these cases. Who are these people that were on these message boards investigating the case, and how would you describe this community?
We got to know a few of Michelle's citizen sleuth, fellow sleuths. One of them was Paul Haynes, who was given, the task of finishing her book by Patton, Paul Haynes and Billy Jensen. Paul was terrific at data mining. They kind of all brought these different skills. And what was really amazing was to hear stories of the collaboration. I, you know, Paul could kind of create these maps and with geo data, like figure out where he was moving. And I don't even know how to explain the technological aspect. Michelle was so good at getting folks to talk to her and to give her materials. Then there was this this woman called the social worker, whose name is Melanie, who had was from Sacramento and had all these leads there and sources. So you see them all kind of coming together and becoming like a symphony of information, whereas, you know, alone they would have been kind of, you know, siloed. So these message boards created that community, and it was very vibrant, and law enforcement was talking to them. You know, they were asking them for their help, and it was a very vibrant community.
What were some of the things that Michelle was sort of prescient about? She died before he was caught, but she was on to some things.
Yeah, she expected that he had a law enforcement or military background, which in fact he did. She thought he was from a certain geographical area, which he was, which may sound obvious, but, you know, he committed crimes all up and down the state. So it's not obvious. One thing that was interesting was, and I talked to Billy and Paul about this before D'Angelo was arrested, was they all thought he was alive. And I don't know, I'm not a sleuth, but for me, it was kind of like he stopped committing crimes in 1986. Like, how could, you know, he must be dead, right? And they all really believed he was alive. And of course, you know, we now know they were right. So on a number of levels, they had a good kind of picture of who this guy would ultimately be.
You, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you started working on this project before he was arrested, is that right?
Yes.
So how did that change your approach to telling the story?
Well, you know, I always knew I wanted it to be Michelle's journey and seeing, getting to learn this case through her eyes, which is what we do, getting to meet the survivors that she met. Of course, we go wider than that and we talk to other people as well, but it was the kind, the structural, the point of view of the series. So when he was caught, that didn't really change everything because we still were going on that journey. Episodes 5 and 6 are certainly different because they do focus on how he is identified. And then, you know, in the last episode, we do learn some new things about him. But it didn't totally change the approach to the filmmaking at, in as much as people might think.
I'm curious, you know, there's a little bit of debate about true crime these days, podcasts and TV shows, about the ick factor. Like, are we making television? Are we making content out of incredible tragedy and difficulty in people's lives? How did you think about that before you started? How did you think about it during the course of making the series?
Yeah, I thought about it, and I also know Michelle thought about it, and Paul Haynes, her, you know, her co-author, thought about it. I guess, you know, I've been making films in the criminal justice system for my whole career. The first film I made was called The Farm, Life Inside Angola Prison. It was about 6 lifers there. There are things that are now called true crime that, you know, when I was making that kind of film 20 years ago, people didn't call it that. So I guess I'm confused about what that category actually means. Is it just films about, you know, it feels to me like an amorphous category. And I guess at the end of the day, for me, the way that I can sort of think about what my part in all of this is it, I don't make things that are sensational. Like we try really, really hard to kind of be survivor centered in the case of I'll Be Gone in the Dark and use that as our North Star. But I'm kind of confused about what the category means. And I think that for me, a way to avoid an ick factor is just to be very humanistic about your approach. I don't know how much sense that makes, but it's a, you know, I'm certainly interested in why I'm so interested in it. But I guess I go ahead and make my films in a way that feels respectful and thoughtful and hope I stay away from those tropes.
The name of the docuseries is I'll Be Gone in the Dark. It is on HBO Sundays at 10 p.m. Liz Garbus, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.